Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. I was told as a boy to dream big and that the possibilities awaiting me were endless. Even suffering the loss of my dad in my late teens, I had few doubts that I was going to go on to do some good things in this life. I never in my mind felt otherwise. I learned through this podcast that the ceiling many put on their dreams is a lot lower depending on their circumstances. That's sad. If it's not even an available option, how can you begin to chase what's becoming more and more the elusive American dream? We'll talk about it today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Karen Cerullo. She, along with Janet Ruane, have written a book called Dreams of a Lifetime, How Who We Are Shapes How We Imagine Our Future. They're both sociologists. And I've got to ask you, because there's been a lot written about dreams and how important they seem to be to most of us, or, you know, how they really relate to our conscious life. What was it that you were trying to unlock as sociologists about the element of dreams? Because we spend so much time in bed, and oftentimes we're dreaming.
Well, we weren't looking particularly at the kinds of dreams you have when you're asleep. We're really talking about the sort of fantasies that you have when you're thinking about the future and what you might be or what you might want to have and so forth. So we weren't interested in sleeping dreams, but we're looking at waking dreams. It turns out that there hasn't been a lot written in this area. To be sure, there's been books and articles written about things like aspirations and goals, where in particular with regard to education or jobs, you'll be thinking about how you're going to plan to get something that you want. And there's been a fair amount of writing done on hopes, which are still situated in reality. So you get sick and you hope for a cure. You meet the person and you hope for a long marriage. But dreams, we felt, were something a little bit different. They kind of happen in the privacy of our minds. They produce all kinds of benefits for people and say all kinds of things about ourselves. So, for example, they might help comfort us. They might make us happy. They might excite us. And they really are about the kinds of things that are at the core of our identity. We tend to dream or fantasize about things with regard to the future that really are about who we want to be, where we want to belong, where we want to land if we were taking the paths in our life that had no obstacles. And we wanted to learn a little bit more about that process.
But let me just go back to this notion of the conscious mind versus the unconscious, because in reading your book, I did get the sense, for me, that we were still talking about whatever our dreams were and wherever they came to us, and that some of them might have been as we're daydreaming or as we're imagining or hoping or wishing and hoping, as Dusty Springfield once said, but that there was also maybe a governor or a limit on the things we might even dream about when we are sleeping. In terms of who we really are, that it's so part of what we have understood ourselves to be based on our society and our expectations. And of course, you do, you know, deal with the American dream, which is so much a part of the ethos of this country. How much of an intersection is there between our conscious awareness of our hopefulness versus that which might happen in these off hours of unconscious?
I wish I could answer that question, but we were actually pretty careful to make sure that when people were talking to us, that they did not talk to us about dreams they had when they're sleeping. Mm. We wanted to hear their ideas about what happened in their conscious time. And so you're right. There's no reason for us to think that our consciousness doesn't influence our unconsciousness and vice versa. We're careful not to talk to people about sleeping dreams because we were really trying to get more at people's projections for the future and where they would love to go, even if it wasn't realistic and even if they never planned and never accomplished it. Where did they want to go and what did that say about who they were?
Exactly. And you talk about social location really invading our private imaginings of the future. Explain that concept for those who did not take a lot of sociology courses, what social location is.
I will, and I hope maybe I'll convince some people to take some sociology courses along the moment.
I enjoyed them.
when we talk about social location, we're talking about sort of where you're standing in the society. So social location encompasses your social class background. It encompasses your race and ethnic background. It encompasses your gender. It encompasses, you know, your age and where you are in the lifespan. And for us, it also encompassed kind of what was going on, the context of your lives. We wanted to interview, for example, people who had some disruptions in their lives, either because they had gotten a bad health diagnosis or they had lost a job, or they had been displaced either by poverty or a natural disaster. So we wanted to look at all of those different situations and all of those different characteristics that you carry around with you to see if they related to some sort of pattern in the kinds of dreams that people have.
You do say to us that studying dreams gives us another avenue for a better understanding, and I think this is the most important element of your book, the whole concept of inequality. And let me just unpack that a little bit, because when I was young, I mean, my dad, just by seeing who he was, even though he died at a very young age, I have kind of followed in his footsteps. There was so much that I internalized early on, even though we really didn't have a lot of money. It was always known to me, at least in my being, that I was going to go to college, that I was going to aspire to do something in a lifetime. And so there was a certain inculcation that happened early on, even though perhaps I wasn't either led in that direction consciously, or I wasn't led to believe that we had endless resources to help my dreams come true. It was just a certain path that I sensed I was on, and I don't know, you know, where that came from, but I would imagine that somebody who didn't have that kind of tutelage and that kind of you know, fellowship with their parents and their expectations might have been led down a totally different path.
Well, yeah, you know, that's what we find, is that people who are in certain social positions, let's say, for example, we talk about class, what we found is that while people who were in what we might think of as a lower class thought it was important to dream, thought it was vital to your well-being to dream, they also did not believe, for the most part, that their dreams would come true, and they did not tend to dream big. Whereas people who were in wealthier classes or in middle class, who, as you said, sort of internalized that there were possibilities for them, had much bigger dreams. You know, one of the examples I could give here had to do with people who had dreams about careers. When we talk to people who were in the upper or middle class, their idea of a career dream was to move up the corporate ladder, to get the big corner office, or to become an angel investor, or to start their own businesses. Whereas people who were in the lower class, when they thought about career, for them it meant to, you know, to have a job, to keep a job so that they could put food on the table. Or if they felt, you know, they wanted to start a business, it was a small business, like a small grocery store or flower shop. So, you know, career meant very different things to people and very different dreams, depending on if they were at the bottom or the top of the economic ladder. You know, interestingly, too, we saw this kind of thing with gender. We found that men were much more likely to have dreams that were sort of consistent with a macho stereotype. So they would be the people dreaming about whitewater rafting and having adventures and going to the moon, or dreaming of fame, wealth, and power. You know, again, having that corner office or becoming a billionaire. Interestingly, women most often had dreams about family, having children, keeping their families together, having a long marriage, or dreams about self-improvement, which again, with the feminine stereotype, often had to do with how they looked. So again, these messages, while they weren't sort of being stated in an overt way, were making their way into people's minds and, you know, influencing what they thought it was appropriate to dream about, even before they set about trying to start their lives.
Now, your methodology, the people you talk to, you might want to help us understand that so we can put ourselves in that place. And also, you know, the American dream, whether you're a woman or a man, or whether you're black or Asian or white, there is this overriding sense of the American dream. How much does that pervade the thinking of all of us? Because as much as we don't think we're propagandistic in America, the Chinese have been studying our films, recognizing that perhaps in the 20th century, our greatest export was our culture and the sense of possibility in America. So how did that really fit into all the other things that affect where we see ourselves going, imagining, planning, dreaming, hoping? Help us understand all of this in context.
A few things come to mind. First of all, you know, we found that when people talked about dreaming of the future, there were sort of two perspectives. One was that everybody would have a different dream, that everybody's an individual and no two dreams would look alike. And then at the other end of the scale were people who would say, there's not going to be much variation at all. If you're in the United States, it's the American dream, and that's what everybody's dream is. What we found was that people were sort of in between those two parameters, that, yeah, there was a variation in people's dreams. But at the same time, we could boil people's dreams down to six major themes. And they were dreams about your career, dreams about philanthropy, doing something for others, dreams about adventure and about fame, wealth, and power, dreams about family, and dreams about self-improvement. So we are more diversified than just the American dream, but we are by no means completely individualistic in what we dream about. Now, you mentioned the American culture of optimism. And one of the things that we did do to sort of understand, you know, what is the field in which people are creating their dreams, was to code the content of all sorts of things that have messages about dreams, you know, novels, films, TV shows, websites, anything you could think of, and to see if we could draw out the messages that were being conveyed to people. And we did find, in fact, that much more often you find positive lessons in these venues, things like opportunity is boundless, or dream big, or you know, never give up on your dreams, or be optimistic because it makes anything possible. And there were, however, some negative themes. The idea that the deck is stacked against some people, or that if you dream too big, you're going to rise high but then fall quickly. And we found that, you know, again, people's social locations, their class, their race, their gender, et cetera, had some impact on whether people grabbed those positive messages or whether they grabbed the negative messages. Now, I wanted to address the methodology, too, and walk you through that. What we did was to reach out to various churches, schools, community centers. We talked to neighborhood groups. We talked to senior citizen groups. We actually interviewed people as early as age 8 in the 3rd and 4th grades and as late as people in their 80s. And we did two types of contact. We did a number of interviews where we just sat one-on-one with people and talked with them. And we also did some group interviews or focus groups where we had 5 or 6 people in a group at once. Altogether, that meant we talked to about 272 people over the course of about 7 or 8 months. And what we would do to get these interviews going is to ask people this question. If you knew you couldn't fail, what would you do? Or where might you go? Or what might you want to have? Or, you know, what might you want to be? And we asked people to write down 3 answers to that question, 3 dreams. And then we talked about all of those answers, either one-on-one or in the groups. And in addition, you know, we explored other elements of dreaming, like, you know, what area did people's dreams fall into? I mentioned those 6 categories earlier. Mm-hmm. Were their dreams feasible? Were they realistic or were they fantastical? We wanted to know how clearly they envisioned these dreams. And who was included in them? Were they the only star of their dreams or did they have other people included in their dreams? We wanted to know how long they held on to their dreams, whether they ever saw themselves passing their dreams on to their children or possibly people that they mentored. And finally, we wanted to know how important they saw it to be a dreamer. Did they think dreaming was important?
Now, you talk about the cousins of dreams, aspirations, achievements, motivation. Another cousin is hope. I guess the question is, when somebody says to their young child, oh, you're such a dreamer, you know, at what message are they sending? And how much of our time should we be spending actualizing our hopes for the future or our aspirations versus just kind of sitting there dreaming, if you will? Is that really a form of inaction with hope for outcomes that are unrealistic because we're not working toward them?
Well, I think it depends on why you're dreaming. People told us all sorts of reasons with regard to why they create dreams. Some people said that it comforted them. Some people said that it made them happy. Some people said that it excited them. Some people said that it inspired them. Almost every person we talked to said that it was completely essential to dream. Even if the particular things they were dreaming about were something that at some level they knew could never happen, they still felt that it was important to have that door open, if you will. Because even if you did not get the specific thing you were dreaming about, it gave you ideas and inspirations about things that you might accomplish. And they were not necessarily things that you were doing at the moment or things that might have to do with specific plans, but they were opening new doors for you and allowing you to think about new things. And perhaps most importantly, most people felt that the dreams that they told us about were reflections of who they really were inside, that they were somehow giving insight into the core of who they were and who they wanted to be. So is it a useless task? I think not. I think that what it does is help us to get to know ourselves better. It helps us to put ourselves on track, to be true to ourselves and to pursue things that are true to our identity. But we also think that we shouldn't necessarily think of dreaming as frivolous. We talked at the end of the book about the fact that, you know, if you have someone going to college, you will often see that they might need to take some remedial courses, let's say in math, to sort of bring them up to speed. And we thought that maybe we shouldn't think of dreams as things that are unattainable. But maybe what we need to do is talk more with people about their dreams and help educate people about how they might accomplish either that specific thing or something like it, how they might get to the place that they're dreaming about. We don't spend a lot of time coaching people on their dreams. We felt that maybe it was something we needed to do, particularly for people who are in disadvantaged positions for one reason or another. It might be a way to help lift them up.
You say the dreams are their own unique beast, and they are imaginings that aren't necessarily rational, observable, or linked to planned patterns of action. So when do we know we're dreaming versus we're really trying to figure out a plan to get from here to there and thinking about all the obstacles in the way? And when do we do most of our dreaming, our conscious, awake dreaming?
Well, I think that that happens all throughout the day. I think it can happen when something good happens to you. I think it can happen when you're not doing anything in particular and you're just thinking about what you'd like the future to look like. I think it can happen when you're having a bad day, a good day. So I think that that happens throughout the day, that we let ourselves slip into these private little places in our mind and think about what our future might be or could be. But I think the difference between a dream, I'd love to give you a concrete example.
Sure.
One of the people that I spoke with before we even started this study was my mother-in-law, because this project arose from my doing errands for Christmas, and I heard a talk radio announcer throw out the question to the audience, if you knew you couldn't fail, what would you do? And I was just mesmerized by listening to all of the things people were saying when they called in. You know, I found myself asking myself the question. And at the Christmas table, I asked my mother-in-law, who was 99 years old at the time, and told me, much to my shock, that she would like to be a lounge singer. Now, I had no idea that that had ever been something in her mind. But she went on and said how much she would really enjoy doing that every night. Now, here's the difference, I think, between dreaming about that and doing it. If you really wanted to be a lounge singer, you'd be making plans, right? You'd be developing a repertoire. You'd be maybe going to some open mic nights and trying it out. You'd be looking for jobs. And you'd be trying to work your way toward that goal. But when you're dreaming about it, I think what you're dreaming about is more what it would feel like to be in that position, to have everybody's attention on you, to know that you were bringing these people joy with your voice. And you wouldn't even be thinking about the realism of it. You wouldn't be thinking about, you know, maybe being in a dive or having someone who's had too much to drink heckle you, or the secondhand smoke you're breathing in, or, you know, even the boredom of singing the same songs over and over every night. Instead, you're thinking about being that person who's the center of attention, who is really embraced by the people who are in that cocktail lounge or bar, and who are just enjoying, you're making them happy. So that's, you know, a very different thing from planning sort of a specific end for yourself or career for yourself.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I'm in an old guy's rock band. And I always ask the question, are you sure this is the way the Beatles started, as you're lugging equipment at 1 o'clock in the morning from one of those kinds of establishments that you just talked about? And it's not all glory. You know, the playing is fun, but getting it there and breaking it down is really not fun. Dreams of a Lifetime. Karen Cerullo and Janet Ruane. Karen is with us. And Karen, you talked about that 99-year-old mother-in-law, and you said that age is a major distinguishing factor among dreamers, regardless of other factors such as class, race, or gender. Explain that, how our dreams evolve and change over time. Do our expectations lessen? I just want to have a good day by waking up and feeling good that day, as opposed to, wow, I've got this big thing that I want to accomplish. Or can we hold on to those dreams even into our 70s, 80s, and 90s?
We found some very interesting things about age. You know, we decided to start in terms of age with third and fourth graders, because we thought that's probably around the time where they could understand what we meant by dreaming. And the first thing that surprised us with regard to age was the difference in the dreams of third graders versus fourth graders. Third graders were, you know, had these fantastical ideas about, you know, owning giraffes or being able to fly or be invisible or hold their breath underwater forever. By the time we got to the fourth grade, things got a little bit more realistic. And we noted that because we thought, well, right around 10 years old, right around the fourth grade, you're being drawn away from those fantasies and you're being, you know, sort of guided into thinking about somewhat more realistic things. So we had more career dreamers, kids who wanted to program computer games or who wanted to become doctors so they could cure illnesses that people in their families might have had. We even had a kid who told us he wanted to earn $1 million and double it. In his mind, that meant becoming a billionaire so he could buy things. And I said, well, what would you like to buy? And his answer was the Eiffel Tower. Now, yeah, that is still kind of a childish dream, but still, this was somebody who had already gotten into the sort of capitalistic mind frame. As opposed to wanting to fly, he was wanting to earn money and, you know, acquire things. We found that in the middle of the life cycle, people who were sort of in early midlife, had been married for a few years, had some children, maybe still young children, that these are people who sort of put the brakes on dreaming. That they were telling us, you know, I can't really afford the luxury of dreaming right now because what my sole task has to be to make sure that my kids are getting what they need and that I am getting them on the right path. And then we found that by the time we talked to the 60, 70, 80-year-old folks, dreaming exploded again. There was no holding back. You know, we talked to some people who wanted to whitewater raft. We talked to some people who wanted to motorcycle across the country. We talked to someone who had always wanted to be a doctor and thought she still had time, that she ended up being a chemist, but that she might have known enough that maybe she could get into a medical school. So those folks were not, we had a guy who wanted to be president of the United States, had no political background, never held an office in his life, but said to me, hey, I'm about the same age as Donald Trump and he became president, so why couldn't I? So there were these, you know, ebbs and flows, and age did make quite a bit of difference in terms of how people dreamt and what they dreamt about and how prolifically they dreamt.
When you think of young people, there are so many messages in children's programming, in books that are designed for children that encourage that. Disney itself is really one big dream. Jiminy Cricket's promise, when you wish upon a star, makes no difference who you are. Anything your heart desires will come to you. So we have these really fantastical notions of possibility. Now, the society, as you go along and you pick up the expectations, the burdens, and so forth, how does that affect the individual as it relates to dreaming? Because there's so much in there, at least for most people who have access to that type of content at a very young age and that type of encouragement at almost every level.
Well, you know, we found that, you know, I was saying to you before that we've sort of teased out both the positive and negative lessons on dreaming that, you know, abound in our culture. And what we found was that there were certain groups, people who were in the low income group, our Latinx respondents, people who had lost their jobs, for example, the unemployed. These were people who knew those positive ideas were out there, but they were clinging to the negative elements of dreaming. And they were saying, while they felt dreaming was important, they really didn't believe that their dreams would ever come true, that they didn't have a chance of ever accomplishing their dreams. And that we felt was not only important, but a very sad thing to learn, that, you know, that you can be have a certain background, and even that joy of dreaming can be destroyed by the disadvantaged position that you're in.
What about psychology versus sociology? By that I mean, there are these stories in America, and again, America likes to really announce those possibilities and endless opportunities, Horatio Alger stories, or I've met lots of folks who are in no position to imagine great things given their current circumstance, and yet I hear them talking about, oh, I plan to do this, and I'm going to be this, and so forth. And I love that. I mean, it's very encouraging. I mean, I'm not certain how dispirited they get if it doesn't come true, but I'm just wondering how much of it is your psychology versus the sociology that really affects all of us. You know, the people who are, you know, glass half full versus half empty.
Well, you know, I think that there's an element of both involved here. But I think, you know, as a sociologist, I can't predict what will necessarily be the case for you as an individual. Mm-hmm. What I look at is what are the general trends across a society or across a specific group. And one of the things we found that, you know, if you talk about the glass half full, the glass half empty, that how you saw the liquid in that glass was very influenced by things like your class and your race and your gender and the experiences that you were having at a given time and your age and so forth. That there are certain moments and certain places in our lives where people who occupy these disadvantaged positions are just not likely to see the glass half full no matter how much they hear that message in the society. And then there are others who are in more advantaged positions who will always see the glass half full. Even if they fail, they will never give up that perspective.
Here we are today talking in 2022. And we have some things that are going on that are very disconcerting. I don't care what age you are. I grew up in the 1960s. I still hold a lot of the values of the 1960s, the music, the sense of possibility that America was actually trying to improve itself. So someone who's growing up today, when they see outside their door the rancor and the discouragement about us ever coming together again as a people to look forward, because lots of people are looking backward and saying, let's do that again, what we did back when many of us weren't happy with what was happening. Others saying, we still have a long road ahead of us to make this society better for all of us. How difficult is it to dream in America 2022?
Well, let me answer that question by telling you a little anecdote, although it's not necessarily about America, but I think relates. I was watching a newscast about what's going on in the Ukraine, and the reporter was, you know, walking through the streets, talking to people who were in these demolished cities and so forth. And one of the guys that he stopped to talk to started asking the reporter a lot of questions about the Super Bowl in the United States. And after asking a lot of questions, he told the reporter, you know, my dream is to go to the Super Bowl, and I know it's going to happen. I am going to get to the Super Bowl. And I thought, boy, this guy's standing there with a rifle in his hand, looking at his home completely demolished, and he's still hanging on to that dream. And I think we have a lot of people like that in the United States. We see that things are tough. We're looking, staring down inflation. We're staring down a lot of hate. We're still dealing with COVID, but people are still looking at those things and nevertheless saying, I'm not going to let that stop me from dreaming, because dreaming is essential. Dreaming is important. And, I think that we as we saw in the people we talked with, the large majority of people will continue, to dream.
Now, you did talk about those who had experienced ruptures, disasters, war, major trauma, a lot of that going on around the world today. And I know that I had David Gergen on, and he talked about leadership. And we talked about the fact that if leadership is born out of crisis, then Ukraine is going to have some remarkable democratic leaders going forward who know right. What it was like to have persevered and struggled to attain and retain that freedom. So I guess in the context of that, for the dreamers in Ukraine and many other parts of the world that are suffering from various kinds of uncertainties, afflictions, and the like, what do you expect? Bigger dreams?
I am really expecting to see bigger dreams coming from people both in the U.S. and in all of the troubled places around the world that we're looking at. You know, I think, for example, right now, the fact that we see people, despite the fact that we're sort of experiencing another surge in COVID, that we see people continuing to go about their lives, people want to live the life that they dream of. They're not going to give up easily on it. And I expect that we are going to see some fabulous leaders emerge from places in the world that are troubled by war. And I think that we're going to see a generation that has come out of the COVID period who are going to be willing to dream and willing to do what it takes to make those dreams come true.
Well, I've got to tell you that I think this is a really important set of information for an audience to be thinking about their own dreams in the context of the society in which they were raised and the expectations perhaps that their parents had for them and how they've internalized those things. And again, you remind us as a broader conclusion to your study that dreaming cannot be said to be one thing or another, good or bad. It really depends on who you are and where you are among many different strata and many different subsets. So it's a very complex thing. Did you find it to be even more complex than you thought when you started to study this?
We did. We thought that we would find some patterns that were different from the expectations that people express, that it's either everybody's dream is different or everybody dreams about one American dream. But we were surprised to see how complicated things could get when you really looked at all of the factors that make up a person and what it would mean for their dreams. One of the things, though, that I'd love to throw out to your listeners is,
sure.
I mentioned that we had, before we started writing the book, threw this question out to our family members at the holidays. We both come from families that are, let's say, split down the middle politically. And so there can be some heated discussions at the dinner table at the holidays. But when we threw this question out, we couldn't get over how all of those differences diminished. And everybody was willing to talk about their dreams and listen to other people's dreams. And it really got a good conversation going. A conversation that was completely devoid of tension. So it's an exercise that would be good for people to try at their own dinner tables, I think at their own family gatherings. Perhaps leave your gathering with a friendly feeling toward one another as opposed to the kinds of things that we're hearing people describe now when they get together with family members who have different political views.
So again, that question, if you knew you couldn't fail, what would you do? Well, I tell you, I certainly didn't fail in asking you to be part of the podcast today. We like to explore lots of things in our society. And one thing I would ask you to leave us with is the notion, is dreaming trending? Meaning, is it becoming, in your mind, more prevalent? Or are people so mired in the day-to-day that they're having a hard time looking out above the clouds? What would you say we're trending as it relates to dreaming in America?
I think that there's never really a thing as a peaceful, calm time. And so I think people are dreaming as much today as they ever did. And I think we will see people continue to dream because, as I said, almost everyone we talked to thought it was just an essential part of life. So I think it's neither increasing or decreasing. I think it has always been a part of American psyche.
Okay. Janet Ruane and Karen Cerullo, the book Dreams of a Lifetime. I thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Thank you for having me. It was really a pleasure.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.